Good afternoon. This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, October 5th, 2020. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ahead this afternoon, some people are still afraid to seek primary care during the pandemic. We'll hear how the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences is working to ease those fears with a drive-through clinic. Plus, an Arkansas case involving the regulation of pharmacy benefit managers heads to the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll have a preview of tomorrow's oral arguments. The Arkansas Department of Health reported almost 1,000 more confirmed COVID-19 cases over the weekend and 237 positive antigen test results. 33 more Arkansans died from the virus, bringing the state's confirmed death count to 1,278. ADH reports 509 patients are hospitalized, an increase of 34 since Friday. There are just over 6,400 active cases in the state, 178 fewer than Friday. Governor Asa Hutchinson's weekly update on the virus is scheduled for tomorrow afternoon. Today is the final day to register to vote in Arkansas. You can contact your local county clerk's office if you have any questions. The Benton County Clerk's offices in Bentonville, Rogers, and Siloam Springs will all be open until 7:30 this evening to assist anyone with registration. Eligible voters may transfer their registration to another county within the state up to 4 days prior to the election. The deadline for that is close of business October 30th. In May, Governor Asa Hutchinson declared Arkansas restaurants could reopen for limited dine-in service, but some restaurants have only recently started to open their dining rooms, while others are relying on to-go dining or outdoor seating. With revenue trailing 35% behind last year, restaurants are still trying to adapt to make up lost ground. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth reports.
Thank you, baby. One Moscow meal?
Yeah.
Got it.
Bartender Anthony Taylor stands behind the bar at Maxine's Tap Room in Fayetteville and makes a drink from behind a plexiglass screen. Most booths and tables have been removed from the railway-style bar on Block Street, and it's mostly empty inside except for a steady trickle of people grabbing to-go drinks to take to Maxine's new patio, a parking lot now set up with school bus seats as benches and makeshift cocktail tables. Maxine's co-owner, Hannah Withers, says getting to this new setup has been challenging.
We did sort of a soft opening at Maxine's where we tried a lot of things that didn't work within that first night that we switched immediately. I think for us having our places closed for over five months, it was sort of a mental hurdle to get past, to move into a point where we where we were open to having more people in that place. We also, in that long 70-foot bar that runs through Maxine's, we have 24 bar seats, and there are only four of them on a good night that we can seat that are socially distant enough from the other tables. And so we have one of our bartenders is sort of now more of a cocktail waiter who goes to those tables to take their order and brings it to them, which is a really big shift. I mean, I think on high-volume nights, they're used to being able to serve really fast, speedy drinks with four people deep at the bar, and this is there's a lot of space in there when we're at capacity right now.
According to the Arkansas Department of Health Directive on Dining issued in June, restaurants and bars are allowed to have up to 66% occupancy, but must maintain a 6-foot distance between tables, and all patrons and staff are required to wear a mask when not eating or drinking. For many restaurant owners, these new restrictions are fundamentally changing previous modes of operation. Withers also runs a restaurant in Fayetteville, Leverett Lounge, which she says is still seeing more to-go service.
So at Leverett, I think we're adjusting to doing a much lower dine-in volume than we used to do, but we're also adjusting to a huge uptake in takeout orders. And so we have an entire station that's dedicated to that. That's a lot of timing with the kitchen. And it's a completely different, it's a different flow for all of us to sort of fit that in.
Both the bar and restaurant have been open since August, but in late September, they had to close because of a possible COVID-19 exposure. 4 employees tested positive for the coronavirus. And while not required by the Department of Health to close or disclose the cases to the public, Withers says transparency was the best option.
When you have one case and you work in a small place with people, then you want to be as careful as possible. So we had one person who was showing symptoms who tested positive on Thursday morning, and we immediately closed down and had, we had 3 bartenders at Maxine's that tested positive and 1 server that tested positive at Leverett, and everybody else was negative. So we waited the 5-day sort of incubation period in case people were showing a negative test but not quite showing symptoms yet. So we've got everybody retested as of this week, and all of our folks who are negative are coming back to work. And financially, that's a pretty big hit. I feel like we're probably running about 60-70% of our normal sales at Maxine's and about 50% of our normal sales at Leverett. And when it takes more staff and you're adding more labor into that equation, we've got a little while that we can float and make that sustainable. But as far as a long-term equation for any of us making a living, it's not realistic to think that that's going to last long.
And that's a struggle that a lot of restaurants are facing. Jeremy Gothrop, chef and owner of Woodstone Pizza in Fayetteville, says his restaurants tried to do curbside and to-go orders only at the beginning of the pandemic.
We opened up just curbside and a little bit of patios and quickly realized that that wasn't cutting it financially, wasn't cutting it. Didn't feel like a good time. Numbers were starting to climb. So we closed again and also realized that we needed to keep whatever gas we had in the tank there until the right time to open, which was still a very confusing time on when that might be.
Woodstone's Uptown location in Fayetteville reopened on September 15th. The other location off of Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard remains closed. Gothrop says new safety measures had to be put in place in order for the Uptown location to reopen safely.
We're currently building a 1,700 square foot deck on top of the patio that we have. Safety protocols definitely more ramped up than ever. Keeping the kitchen in masks and gloves, keeping our front of house staff in masks with frequent hand washing. You know, we've installed some plexiglass at the host stand. Face shields for the dishwashers who are handling, the wares and plates and things from the customer. We're working a lot of employees in pods in case there is, testing from one of our employees or their roommates with COVID. We'll be able to isolate certain members but keep the doors open while we move through this thing. It's a concept. We'll see how well it works. Some restaurants are adopting this pod concept of working. But really, it's just a constant reminder of everybody to keep the space while they're prepping, keep the space while they're doing everything.
And all of these new measures are putting added financial pressure on an already precarious industry. Monty McNulty with the Arkansas Hospitality Association says consumers are seeing some price increases to make up for the cost of adding on labor and personal protective equipment.
And if restaurants aren't looking at their food costs and just their cost of doing business, that's going to be a problem for them, because early on, you see in the grocery stores, the price of beef, the price of chicken, the price of everything has gone up some. And so their prices have gone up, and they need to analyze that and pass that on to their customers if they're going to survive.
She also says establishments unequipped to offer both takeout and dine-in service are more susceptible to financial losses.
The restaurants that are doing well, and when I say well, they're surviving, but are the ones that were equipped to start out doing, they have windows and they have drive-through, carry-out, but the ones that were not equipped to do that and had to adjust their expenses involved in that. And their staff's not equipped to do it, not trained to do it. So there's a big gap in succeeding that way.
And the pressure isn't just on owners and customers. New measures add more responsibility for restaurant staff as well.
As a manager, you almost even have to like police it more and just like be adamant about it. Now you have to see how, watch how close people are standing together when they're working. You have to make sure their mask is on, their mask is covering up their whole face, you know, they're wearing it properly. So it's just thing, you're tempting everyone as they come into the building. It's just things that, you know, in the old world, as I've been calling it, you never really thought about.
That's Bill Sharp, a kitchen manager for Woodstone Pizza in Fayetteville. And he says the risks extend beyond the workplace.
I've accepted it now, but I had trepidations about, it's like, you know, I'm not really a bar goer. I don't go out much like that. But obviously, that's a very popular thing in the kitchen community. And so now I have to trust that the three people next to me are being as safe as I'd want them to be, as safe as I'm being, to hope that they're not going to bring it into our restaurant and get our whole staff infected, right?
And Bunsu Walker, a waitress at Thai Isan in Fayetteville, says working her usual 9-hour shifts at the restaurant are more challenging now because of the new restrictions and reduced staff.
You know, think of if you have to wear masks all day when you open dining, it's going to be very uncomfortable. I'd rather work without masks, you know. I'd rather work without no gloves, but it is harder.
And back at Maxine's, Hannah Withers says the biggest challenge facing the industry going forward is the weather. This summer, Fayetteville passed an outside refreshment area, which allows patrons to take to-go drinks from bars and restaurants through much of the city's downtown. And that's helped a lot of businesses bring in customers. But as the weather gets colder, restaurants aren't sure what to do.
It's complicated, and I think that we're going to see a lot of small hospitality places that are probably not going to make it into the winter. I know that a lot of us are having conversations about what happens when the weather changes this winter and how we're going to continue to serve people outside, you know, when we get what could be a drastic Arkansas winter. And I don't know, none of us really know what that's going to look like. But I don't know. We're just going to have to wait and see.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carruth.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is offering you the chance to win a $100 gift certificate from Garden IQ Organics. Garden IQ has been providing Arkansas with organic gardening solutions and certified USDA organic plant starts since 1978. Winner announced October 16th. Registration and information available at KUAF.com.
University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences Northwest in Fayetteville is operating a drive-through clinic for patients wary of entering a medical facility during the pandemic. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich met with the principal physician who initiated the clinic and has this report.
The UAMS Northwest drive-through clinic, located at the North Street entrance off College Avenue, where the former Washington Regional Hospital ER once existed, is busy with patients this morning. Dr. Hunter Judkins is medical director for UAMS Northwest Family Medicine Residency Program.
And we have set up an extension to the family medicine clinic here, basically in the entrance, so that we can see our patients in an outside environment.
This drive-through clinic extension features a large roof to protect clinicians and patients during inclement weather. An electronic medical record station is set up just inside the automatic sliding glass door entrance, where medical supplies are also stowed. We step inside the medical library to talk, where it's quieter.
This is a part of the UAMS Family Medicine Residency. And we've always had a walk-in section to our family practice clinic upstairs in our clinic. And when the pandemic hit in the spring, nearly all the in-person visits disappeared, and with good reason. And we did a lot of telephone visits. We did a lot of video visits. And but there were still people that needed to be seen, and ill people who needed to be seen. So we moved our same-day staff, our nurses and our residents, downstairs to the entrance here
patients with possible infectious respiratory issues, including common colds, influenza, strep throat, bronchitis, or pneumonia, are channeled through this drive-thru. Judkin says the drive-thru option is a safe way to see patients beyond telephone and video consults.
We're in the full PPE with the mask, the shields, the gowns, and the gloves, so that, you know, when people call, especially now still, that the people who are ill with fevers or coughs or shortness of breath, et cetera, we can see and evaluate those folks here in our drive-through clinic without bringing them all the way through the building.
UAMS Family Medical Clinic accepts all insurance, including Medicare and Medicaid, and is welcoming new patients.
Well, typically, most of who we see are established patients, and they will call for an office visit, and the receptionist will ask them questions about why they're scheduling. And if it's a same-day appointment, even if it's not necessarily infectious, but certainly the potentially infectious patients, instead of being scheduled upstairs in our clinic, which is still open, we're still seeing a lot of patients there, the most actually since the pandemic just recently. But if they have any sort of infectious symptoms, then we will typically send those people, and we'll schedule a time for them, and then they will show up with their car. And then we see the patients in their car, and we can do quite a bit. We do their vitals, we do take their history, we do their examination. If they need a flu swab or a strep screen or the COVID swab, we can all do that right from their car seat.
Patients can also obtain a COVID-19 PCR test and soon rapid antigen test. Judkin says they've tested several hundred patients for COVID-19, resulting in around 50 positive cases so far. The drive-thru clinic first opened in May, he says.
It's really run very smoothly, and the residents and the staff work very hard. And we also have faculty who work this clinic. I work this clinic at times, and we've all pulled together to make it work.
Judkins, who obtained his MD in Arkansas, first practiced family medicine in Fairbanks, Alaska, starting in 1985 with an emphasis in adult medicine, returning to Arkansas in 2013 to join the UAMS Family Medicine Residency as a faculty member. The drive-through clinic, he says, charges an office visit fee,
which is different than a lot of screening places and events, where basically, you know, they're just doing testing. We do vital signs, we can do blood pressure, we do that, we take full histories, relatively complete examinations in terms of what's required for the visit. And then, you know, we treat their flu. If they've got, a rash that needs a cream, we prescribe that. So we try to give them full service as what we would have done upstairs, but just in a different setting that people are more comfortable with.
Nearly 40% of Arkansans are delaying health care, according to a hospital review survey published in early August. But as the year progresses, more patients are seeking primary care in clinics.
Yeah, we still have patients who are not comfortable coming into almost any building, and especially a medical building where there may be other sick people. So I think, although we feel that, you know, we've now provide a very safe environment, including from COVID, and are very comfortable with people coming in for their chronic medical problems, there are some people who are still not comfortable with that. And we are trying to see those people also in this clinic so that it's an environment where they feel safer and perhaps can get caught up on some of their chronic medical needs that they've postponed.
Judkin says UAMS Northwest Clinic has gotten busy again seeing patients who've put off medical care, and he says he's being queried by other medical practitioners about the drive-thru clinic and is conferring with colleagues about providing safe primary care to patients as the coronavirus pandemic continues.
Part of what I want to do is to not discourage people from getting care in their clinics, because we do feel that we have all learned how to how to safely take care of people, and including high-risk people, indoors. So this is not the only answer. This is one of the answers. But I think many patients, including at our clinic and other clinics, are returning, and very safely so, and getting that medical care that they need to be getting.
Late summer, he says, drive-through patients fell off, with more venturing inside for appointments.
And then with school starting and fall, and then the other respiratory viruses and strep, and now we're having positive influenza. Now we've had a couple of positives this week. This clinic downstairs is getting busier again, because we're still, when people call and they have fevers or they're sick, since we have this option, then we bring them to the outside clinic.
But with winter approaching, Dr. Judkin says the fate of the outdoor clinic is unknown. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
UAMS Northwest Medical Clinic has locations in Fayetteville and Springdale and is accepting new patients. To schedule a drive-through patient appointment, you can call 479-521-8260. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments tomorrow in Arkansas's appeal of a case regarding reimbursements pharmacies receive from insurance providers. The case involves a 2015 law passed by the Arkansas legislature and has the potential to be a precedent-setting case. To learn more about the background of the case, as well as what's at stake, Michael Hiblin from our content partner KUAR in Little Rock spoke with Dan Gorenstein, co-host of the health policy podcast Trade-Offs, and a former senior healthcare reporter for Marketplace.
The Arkansas law was designed to regulate pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs. First, explain, what are PBMs?
Yeah, it's not always easy to really understand what a pharmacy benefit manager is. And I think the way I've always tried to understand it is, you know, they're often described as middlemen, but I think the point is that large employers hire these companies, these PBMs, to negotiate deals on prescription drugs. And so a PBM's job is to get an employer the lowest price possible for prescription drugs. And along the way, they want to make a little bit of money for themselves.
And this was initially set up, or at least proponents of this say it was set up to encourage pharmacies to seek out the lowest cost generic medications.
Yes. So what the employer wants is to pay as little for prescription drugs as possible. And so the PBM has an incentive to try to control costs up and down the supply chain. And there are lots of different steps between the drug maker and you when you go to the pharmacy. One of the ways that the PBM tries to control costs is to negotiate with a pharmacy, you know, a chain pharmacy or a mom and pop pharmacy. And what they'll basically do is they'll come to the pharmacist and they'll say, we represent 10,000 employees. And if you want that business, if you want those customers to come in your store, you're going to have to carry these certain drugs at the price we tell you to pay. And what was happening in Arkansas and what happens in other states is the price could be so low that the pharmacy itself ended up taking a loss on that drug.
Our attorney general, during a conference call with reporters last week, said that has led to many of the small mom-and-pop pharmacies losing so much business that I believe she said about 14% during 1 year were closing, and citing this. The state legislature responded by putting this law into effect, and the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association filed a federal lawsuit arguing states cannot regulate reimbursements. The court sided with the PCMA, and appeals court agreed. What do you expect now as this Arkansas case goes before the Supreme Court?
Well, I expect, as you, and you talked about this at the outset, Michael, I expect that the outcome could have a significant impact not only on that law you all have there in Arkansas. I think this Supreme Court case could go a long way towards directing how much authority and control states have in trying to regulate drug prices and how much states have the ability to make reforms in healthcare overall.
And 45 states and the District of Columbia have filed briefs supporting Arkansas's case. So this is getting a lot of national attention.
It is, Michael, and I'll tell you why it's getting a lot of attention. And that's because this really is on a high level, this is a battle over what states can do and what large multi-state employers can do. And basically, you've got this law, ERISA, which applies to lots of these large employers, that basically large employers have argued, look, we don't want our health insurance plans to be subject to different regulations in Arkansas and in Texas and Oklahoma. We just want to be beholden to one set of regulations. And in the last several years, courts have, there was a major Supreme Court case in 2016 that sided with employers in this. And one of the reasons why you've got so many states watching this closely is because if the Supreme Court decides in favor of employers here, in favor of the PBMs, it could kneecap states' abilities to regulate employers and the companies that some of these employers hire to do their health insurance work.
Who are some of the groups that are supporting the PBMs?
So you've got the Chamber of Commerce and the American Benefits Council, which represents 400-plus large employers, including AT&T, Pepsi, and Apple. And then, you know, you have lots of states, as you said, supporting Arkansas, as well as the President Trump's administration, the Solicitor General.
Well, the Supreme Court has scheduled an hour to hear this case with justices joining by conference call. The state Solicitor General, Nicholas Baroni, will speak on behalf of Arkansas, have 20 minutes. Then the U.S. Solicitor General will have 10 minutes. PCMA will then have 30 minutes to make its case. And then the state will have a chance to rebut that. Then justices will be able to ask questions in order of seniority. But Dan, safe to say, we probably won't have a decision anytime soon.
I think that's right. One of the nation's premier experts in ERISA law said, it's really hard to know how a court will rule on it. And she said to us, quote, lawyers and law students and even the Supreme Court justices hate ERISA because it's so difficult to apply. It's like putting a fence around a cloud. And Michael, I feel like when we think about what may happen in this court ruling, it sort of underscores that it really is a potential jump ball. This law, ERISA, is murky. And I think the justices understand just how much is at stake.
That was Michael Hiblin from our content partner KUAR in Little Rock, speaking with Dan Gorenstein, co-host of the health policy podcast Trade-Offs and a former senior healthcare reporter for Marketplace. The U.S. Supreme Court is scheduled to hear oral arguments in the case tomorrow. The first major clusters of COVID-19 in Arkansas were in correctional facilities. For decades, the state has struggled with how to treat inmates. The 1980 movie Brubaker with Robert Redford placed a national spotlight on past problems. For our latest dive into archives from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History, Randy Dixon tells Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums about the real story that inspired the film.
How many men are buried out there? You wouldn't even know, would you? It's crazy. They're digging up bodies. That murder they're talking about in there. And if they condone it, how are you going to turn around and tell these guys why they're locked up?
Robert Redford, Brubaker. This is Ozarks at Large, and it is time to go through some Arkansas archives with Randy Dixon, who is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. And Randy, it felt like we're going to the movies just then. What did we just hear?
Well, we did go to the movies. That was from the 1980 Robert Redford film Brubaker. And it's based on a true story from Arkansas.
And not necessarily a true story that Arkansas was proud of.
No, absolutely not. It was a very dark time, as we have from time to time in Arkansas history. But this was the prison system, the Arkansas prison system, specifically Cummins and Tucker. And that movie was based on a true story, a man by the name of Tom Merton, who was brought in the late 60s to reform our prison system. So I dug into the KETV news archives to sort of take a look at Tom Merton and what happened with his short stay here in Arkansas.
This is a story that kind of covers two gubernatorial administrations, the first of which, the man who was governor for about a dozen years, Orville Favis.
While he was in office, there was a very corrupt prison system. They had what was called a trustee system, which was on its face flawed, I think. There were no regular guards except for a handful in the entire prison. The rest were trustees. They were trusted inmates, but they were armed, and they had permission to control the other inmates. And so that presented a problem in itself, but it was one part of the extreme violence that took place in the corruption. But there was a state police investigation underway under Faubus. And in 1966, he was at the governor's mansion and had just taken a tour of the prison. And this was sort of in the midst of this investigation that was going on that would be released later.
First, let me say that on the inspection tour of the prison today, I found everything well under control and relaxed at the Tucker farm. All the prisoners have gone back to work and everything seems to be fine. While I was there, they presented me a petition signed by a majority of the prisoners, thanking me for correcting some of the wrongs and expressing their appreciation that the improvement is being made. I got over to Cummings and I found that a sit-in was in progress. Out of 1,500 prisoners, 144 were in the barracks. A few of them refused to go out this morning, and others who went out in the fields and sat down were brought back. The total was 144. And in this respect, let me say this. Captain Bishop had plans to build some isolation wards, but the strap is not abolished.
He brought up the strap.
Yeah.
Which ended up being central in part of this corruption and violence. And it was a form of punishment, later considered a means of torture for the inmates. But you hear me talk about Jim Pitcock mm-hmm. all the time. News director, reporter, KTV, my boss, started this archive system, but I speak of him as if he's, I guess, some sort of mythical news god or something. But he lives in Little Rock. He's retired, and he was actually there during all of this period in the late 60s that all of this started to come to light. And I talked to him about Tom Merton and this strap that Faubus was referring to.
It was kind of like a leather strap that a barber used to have that he would, you know, sharpen his razor, except it was about 4 inches wide and about 6 feet long. And what they would do is if one of the inmates was out of line or for any number of reasons, they would tie him to a pole in front of the superintendent's office so everyone could see. And the superintendent then would, you know, give him 8 lashes or 10 or 20, depending on the infraction or the alleged infraction. If he had done something out in the field during the day. So that was really the opening chapter of when we really knew that something was going on down there.
We've heard from Orville Faubus. What about Winthrop Rockefeller, who succeeded Faubus into the mansion?
Yes, he defeated Faubus, came into office in January of 67, and Faubus never released this report. Winthrop Rockefeller did, and it was a very detailed account of, you know, lack of food for inmates, 14-hour work days, violence. And so Rockefeller, early on, vowed to change and reform the prison system, and that's where he hires Tom Merton.
As you know, I obviously have confidence in Mr. Merton, or I wouldn't have brought him into the picture in the first instance. Mr. Merton has applied for the job, and I think Mr. Merton has demonstrated his professional ability, not only as a penologist, but also as a superintendent of Tucker Farm. Therefore, I think he's the logical person to succeed Mr. Bishop, and I propose to make that recommendation to the penitentiary board.
So Rockefeller hires Merton, and he comes in and immediately starts making changes. He's pointing out problems. He's having news conferences. He points out this problem with the strap and how it should not be used. But then another thing that comes up that was shocking, no pun intended, but it was the Tucker telephone, which was an extreme form of discipline, torture, really, that they would take a crank-type device like a telephone, like you would wind up a telephone, that it would generate an electrical charge. And the harder you would crank it, the more of an electrical charge it would make, and they would connect these connectors to various parts of the inmates' bodies, usually their genitals. It was a terrible form of treatment, and he would have news conferences point out these problems, and he did not tread lightly. He didn't always get along with his bosses. He made enemies, and it looked as though he was kind of losing support, and he had a news conference after a meeting he had personally with Governor Rockefeller about some of the things that he was doing.
I didn't really believe we were going down opposite paths. It became apparent in the press that it might be going that way, but I didn't really believe we had a difference of mind, and we've been trying to have this meeting for some time, and I think today we finally have come out of it with the conclusion that we still have the same goals and objectives, and that perhaps a little more frequent contact would help eliminate some of the misunderstandings.
One of the most grisly aspects of this also was graves, unmarked graves on prison grounds. What can you tell me about that?
Well, he started digging. He had an informant in the prison who said that there were hundreds, probably 200 bodies of inmates who had been killed or died of unnatural causes that had been buried in fields. And so he, which brought a lot of attention, including national attention, but he took the media out and started digging up some bodies. He immediately found three bodies, and Jim Pitcock can pick up and talk about Merton and what led to this grave digging.
He came in, and it seemed like everyone was impressed with him, and at first, and then some of his actions resulted in him becoming enemies with some of the folks who had been friends with him and had supported his moves. And I guess the absolute turning point for Merton was the grave digging episode. He contended that those were the graves of inmates who had been shot or whatever. But it happened that it was actually a pauper's graveyard where if an inmate had died at the prison of natural causes and no one had claimed his body, then they would bury him over in an area on the prison grounds. And so that's where they had dug. And Merton got a lot of publicity about it, but it really, after the initial headlines, it really turned out to be pretty much of a nothing story.
And you know, he said that it sort of died down as a news story after another independent state police report came out and thought it was part of a pauper's grave that still is questioned. At least it was by Merton a couple of years later. And, you know, he was accused of grandstanding and wanting the attention. But a couple of years later, he was back in Arkansas speaking to a group at the University of Arkansas, and he defended his actions.
We had an agreement with the Arkansas State Police through Captain Brown and former Major McKee that we were going to dig until we found some evidence one way or the other. And he agreed that it was ridiculous to have a state trooper stand there every time we dug a trench silo on the farm. So the understanding was, which was well known to all parties involved, was that we would continue digging exploratory holes, and when we came up with something, then we would call in the state police, and they at that time would take over the official investigation. This is exactly what was done. It was agreed by Governor Rockefeller, his aides, and myself, and that's exactly the system we followed.
After hearing all this, it is hard to remember, and maybe even a little surprising to remember, he wasn't even here in Arkansas a year, was he?
Yeah, he rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, but he did bring a lot of attention politically through the media and, you know, nationally through the media to the problems that were going on, that he described the Arkansas prison system as the worst in the country. Let's drop back in with Jim Pitcock, and this is his perspective of what happened during that time as a news person.
From the mid-60s until the early 70s, it seemed like something was going on down at either Cummins or Tucker all of the time. I bet over the years we probably made 100 trips down there.
And so the story is not over.
No. Now, that's where the movie ends.
Right.
You know, Brubaker pulls out, he's been fired, and that's kind of what happened, but not with our prison system. So I think we may need one more episode. Is that okay?
That's fine. We'll continue this next week.
Next week we can look at what happened after Merton left, a man by the name of Bob Sarver came in, and he picked it up from there. And so we can look at, you know, a little more on the prison system scandals and what was done to improve a lot of the inmates.
You can find out so much more about Arkansas history and hear from some of the people that made history if you put Pryor Center into a search engine. Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History, joins us most Mondays. Randy, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, thank you. I really enjoyed and look forward to next week.
Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History, and he talks with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums almost every week about episodes and personalities in Arkansas's history.
What is Arabia Terra? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, and this is Scratching the Surface. The past Mariner missions of the 60s and 70s gave us our first real views of the Martian surface, from canyons to volcanoes to dried-up river deltas formed billions of years ago. What is still less explored, however, is the floodplains between such magnificent valleys and deltas. So we're going to take a look at Mars's largest floodplain, Arabia Terra. So let's compare this to Earth for a moment. Rivers on Earth drain from upland areas, cutting into mountainous terrain before they reach their final destination, like a lake or sea. These low-lying areas are floodplains, much like the lower portions of the Mississippi or the Nile rivers. Arabia Terra is very old, completely covered in ancient impact craters and dating back to about 3.9 billion years ago, when most planetary scientists think Mars was at its wettest point in geologic time. What is puzzling is that Arabia Terra has less valley network geology than the other floodplains found around Mars. Recent global climate models of Mars indicated that an early Mars may have actually been a frozen wasteland, with large ice sheets covering most of the northern regions, like where Arabia Terra resides. This could explain why Arabia Terra is not as dissected with valleys.
The KUAF Pluto manager, Caitlin Ahrens, studied space and planetary sciences at the U of A and is currently a postdoctoral researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. Scratching the Surface is a production of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville, Arkansas.
This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Clarksville, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas. Contributors today included Daniel Carruth, Jacqueline Froelich, Kyle Kellums, and Michael Hiblin from our content partner, KUAR in Little Rock. Pete Hartman produced today's Scratching the Surface segment, and our show was mixed and mastered by Timothy Dennis. Our theme song is written and performed by Daryl Sean. If you've missed an episode of our program and would like to get caught up, or if you just want to share a story with a friend, you can find past stories and editions of the show at ozarksatlarge.com. You can also listen to the show as a podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. We'll be back tomorrow at noon with an all-new edition of the program. Until then, thanks for listening, and I hope your week is off to a great start.